brings us back to our goodness, connecting to our amends and letting go and shrinking the self-attack and draining it of its poison. Positive intention frees us from toxic shame, in which we are helpless and miserable, while at the same time allowing healthy remorse. So in a nutshell, this article walks through 12 steps of self-forgiveness. I hope you're writing those down, but don't worry. It's not overwhelming. It actually breaks things down in a way that makes the process feel human and doable. What I appreciated most was that it doesn't skip the hard parts. It talks about owning what you've done, making amends if needed, and then shifting toward self-compassion. But here's where I come in. As someone who struggled to let go of mistakes, I know how easy it is to stay stuck in a guilt spiral. Reading this reminded me that forgiveness isn't about saying, it's fine. It's about saying, I'm ready to heal. And that takes time, not perfection. So if this feels out of reach, just know you're not alone and you're not expected to have it all figured out. You're just asked to start. If you want to share Encouragementology with a friend who needs to know they're not alone in this journey of self-discovery, you can visit encouragementology.com or anywhere you stream your content to receive this episode and all others. Follow us on Facebook and Instagram for additional encouragement throughout the week. So I challenge you, stop seeing your past as a prison and start viewing it as a chapter, one that shaped you but doesn't get to write your ending. Today, choose to unpin yourself from the canvas of old mistakes and start creating something new, bold, and beautifully unfinished. I know you can do it. Thank you for listening to Encouragementology with Kendall Boyson, where we find positive ways to handle some of life's challenges.
Stumbled through until the path was clear. That's when I found you. How I wound up here. All I needed was a rock that I could lean on. All you needed was some wind beneath your wings. We might be seeing things from different points of view, but that don't mean a thing. You and I, we were meant to be. I was made for you.
Hi, this is Pat Metheny. You're listening to Radio KBOO.
Good morning, and thanks for listening to Filament 11 here on your community radio, KBOO Portland. KBOO is, as you know, a volunteer-powered community platform, which means we are funded by you, the listener. This morning, we are joined by our reviewer, Mona Bowen, and by Rick Mitchell of KBOO's Blues Junction, among many other things, all here to discuss Ryan Coogler's hit movie, Sinners.
What y'all doing? Just step aside and let me on in now.
Why you need him to do that? You big and strong enough to push past us?
Well, that wouldn't be too polite now, would it, Miss Annie? I don't know why I'm talking to you anyway. Smoke.
Don't talk to him. You're talking to me right now. Why you can't just walk your big ass up in here without an invite, huh? Go ahead. Admit to it.
Admit to what?
That you're dead.
So you listening to this? Now we out here playing games, telling ghost stories in place of doing what we ought to do.
And what is it we supposed to be doing?
Being kind. kind to one another and being polite. Now, we is one people, and we shouldn't go in barging into other folks' places uninvited. So, you've been in and out of here all day. Ain't never need an invite then. Yeah, something ain't adding up. Can I at least get my money?
Talking thus to a movie expert and to a music expert who's also pretty good on movies. So that's really relevant to this movie, Sinners, because Ryan Coogler's film is about a pair of brothers who happen to be twins who then go back to Mississippi, down the Delta from Chicago, and want to open up a juke joint. And then things transpire. The cast include Michael B. Jordan.
Mm-hmm.
And Delroy Lindo, whom I adore, and various other people, and cameos by numerous people, too, I'm imagining. That's what the movie's about. Rick says it's a really hot movie right now. It shows a lot of respect for Ryan Coogler, I think, if people paid attention to directors anymore, because he had done, I think, it's Fruitvale Station, and then went on to do the Creed Rocky sequels. And then one of the biggest of the Marvel Universe movies and so forth. So do you think that people are going to it because they're saying, oh, another Ryan Coogler movie because he's got a name now? Or are there other factors, do you think?
I don't know that this is necessarily because of Ryan Coogler or Michael B. Jordan, but perhaps both of them together, because Ryan Coogler-Michael B. Jordan relationship is very much to me like Scorsese and De Niro.
Mm-hmm.
Every Ryan Coogler movie has had Michael B. Jordan in, as far as I can tell, and they are really have an incredible synergy. They have done, as you mentioned, all these movies, many different kinds of movies together, you know. Uh-oh. So again, unlike Scorsese, it's not all about the mob or New York, right? but they work very well together. And I think the reason this movie is so big, those names are very important, but I have seen thousands of movies, as you know, and I watch many of them repeatedly. And this is a movie that I'm going to revisit often. Oh. There has been nothing like this. In fact, I'm 100% convinced I'm not going to see a better movie this year. It is a true work of art, but accessible. But it's also a movie, you know. It's really fun. True. It is a roller coaster ride. I want to, you know, you get strapped in, you got to go along for this ride. I was engrossed for every single second of this film. Rick, what do you think?
First, Doug, thanks for having me back on.
Oh, of course.
It's the first time I've been on this program since before the pandemic.
Oh, yeah.
Remember, I was coming on semi-regularly, and that's then true. Everything kind of shut down. I went to see this movie not because I'm a film buff particularly. I like movies fine, but I went because of the music. There hasn't been a movie about the blues since The Blues Brothers. A big budget movie about
that's
the
right.
Mm-hmm. And I would let me just unequivocally say, this is much better than The Blues Brothers. But when I was watching it, my evaluation process in part, is this good for the blues? People have been trying for years to get younger audiences, particularly younger African-American audiences, to revisit our musical heritage. And this movie, I mean, I don't think people are going to be running out to buy Buddy Guy albums, but this movie did a really good job of bringing that to people in a way, as Mona said, that was accessible. Mm. So yes, it was good for the blues. Secondarily, I think the movie is so popular, I've read contradictory opinions. Several reviewers tend to say it's kind of like two movies. There's the setup where they come in and they put the band back together with all their old friends and buy the dance hall. And then there's the second half where it shifts into a vampire movie. One review said it would have been a really great movie without the vampires. Another reviewer said the first part was kind of slow with all the exposition. Then when it got to the action, I'm not a fan of horror movies. I think real life is scary enough without doing something deliberately to scare me. But this movie was not particularly horrifying. Yes, it's very bloody, but it's not the kind of thing that's going to give you nightmares. And it has at least intimations of deeper meanings,
mm-hmm.
politically, racially, culturally, spiritually, that I'm not sure that those promises are completely fulfilled. But I give credit for a blockbuster movie. And I think it's the reason that it's so popular is the second half. The fight scenes, they're just filmed spectacularly.
What some of the reviewers have said, and I would like to draw your attention, gentlemen, to a little known movie named Predator that came out circa 1980. What? That movie was two movies in one, and nobody had a problem with it. Army movie at the beginning, monster movie for the second half. And you know what? It worked.
I'll just say that blending of genres has been one of the primary fallbacks for Hollywood movies these days, since at least Back to the Future and Ghostbusters. Mm-hmm. Blending comedy, time travel, horror things, romance. What's unusual here, it sounds like it's so cut in half that...
Again, I draw your attention to Predator.
Okay.
You know, if Arnold Schwarzenegger can do it, Ryan Coogler and Michael B. Jordan can certainly do it. And I actually think this works very well. I don't think either half works without the other, frankly. There's so much to cover with this movie that it's a little frustrating because I feel that any topic that we pull out, the music, the storyline, the whatever, it is all such a cohesive thing together. It's very hard to pull a thread without entangling the other bits. And that's why the whole movie works as a whole for me.
Okay. But why do you think that they did it in the first place? In other words, when did they decide, was it always a vampire movie?
I think it was. This is a very different take on the vampire movie. Yes, they are vampires. They bite necks and things like that. But these are also, I don't know how else to put it, cultural vampires, if you will.
Oh.
They are not just wanting to take over the bodies of the people they bite, they are wanting to incorporate the cultural parts that have meaning to them. And here is where the music comes in.
Mm-hmm.
There are some really very stirring moments where the vampires are actually playing music. And it is a very meaningful thing for them. They are as hungry for that as they are for the blood of their victims.
Oh, really?
They are creating a cultural family of vampires. There is something they want that is beyond the body and the blood.
I see. Okay. That's interesting. It makes it sound a little bit like the Kathleen Bigelow movie, Near Dark.
Oh, love that movie.
If you recall that one. I know that there's this marvelous monologue in it by Delroy Lindo. And I'm wondering if that is a clue or a key to what happens in the second half.
Let me just say first, the main vampire is Irish. He's an Irish immigrant. Mm-hmm. Although he's, as a vampire, he's been alive for hundreds of years. But there are some reviews, including our friend Armand White in the National Review.
Oh, that guy.
Proved the movie Ethnic Heresy, which is interesting for a guy who writes for the National Review, a black guy who writes for the National
Review. What?
But he mixed up the vampires with the Ku Klux Klan.
Oh.
Ah, KKK, yeah, no.
The KKK is also in this movie, but the head vampire is not a KKK guy. He, at one point, he kind of mumbles, I think I'm going to go get them too. So the allegory that the vampires are basically representing rapacious white music moguls trying to steal black music, which is definitely true if you look at the history of American music, doesn't necessarily line up with what Coogler is trying to say here. The main vampire was summoned to this scene of this dance hall by the power of the music.
Mm.
He wants into the music. And Coogler has made that clear in interviews.
Yeah.
I'm not sure why it matters that the guy is Irish, but it did set the scene for some great dance scenes and musical scenes.
Right.
And there's one magnificent dance scene outside the dance hall where they're all dancing. The visual centerpiece of the movie takes place when they first get the dance hall cranked up.
Uh-huh.
And their young nephew of the two twins who've come back down south to start this dance hall, he starts singing this song, I Lied to You, summons the spirits of the ancestors of black music from Africa to hip hop to funkadelic. They're all dancing, and it's a marvelous sound collage and visual collage.
It's very stirring. That was a masterful sequence, very moving and also really exciting to watch. So that was a sensual feast. It truly was, musically, visually, everything.
Well, you're making me wonder that maybe the reason why the main vampire villain is Irish is because they're linking up to another a folk tradition embedded in another group of oppressed people, who in this case just happened to be Caucasian.
And right. Also happened to be Caucasian and like to eat people.
Yeah. Well, I was,
well, but you know, that. I will say the vampires, when they built their family, were very egalitarian. There was no color or anything. They were all vampires together. You know, there wasn't any, you know, it was the music that was the important thing, you know, of the family they were trying to create. I mean, even though they were vampires and terrible, you know.
So back to Delroy Lindo for a minute. Yeah.
Yes.
He's also one of my favorite actors and has been for a long time. This is not one of his bigger roles. He plays a fairly stock character, an older black blues musician who's kind of zipped away his life because of alcohol. And Delroy plays it perfectly. And there is a story fairly early on when they're riding in a wagon where they pass a chain gang of other former blues musicians that Delroy's character used to sing with. And the story comes up about how Delroy and his partner made a bunch of money and were trying to get away from Mississippi and were basically caught by the Ku Klux Klan, or his partner was, and lynched because he had money in his pocket.
Well, I think that I have a theory that I think you guys have already blasted, which was that Mr. Kugler had come up with a great story and setting, and that harked back in certain ways to his Fruitvale station. But then in discussions, maybe they decided that we got to add something to it, and so let's just turn it into a vampire movie so that it will exist in tandem with all the other African-American-based folk horror movies, about 10 of them from Get Out onward, like The Woman on the Lawn and certain others. And yet now I think that that's wrong, because I think the way that you've described that scene, evoking the shadows and spirits of music past and future, I think that they actually thought that through. That the second half is supposed to be that shocking thing. It doesn't have anything to do with the Ku Klux Klan. It has to do with folk clashing folk traditions, perhaps, or something like that. But anyway, I haven't worked it all out in my head yet, because I just thought of it, and it's only based on what you guys just said to me a second ago. So, but I think that there's a defense of the two-part structure can make sense. It just depends on whether you like vampire movies.
I don't find the two-part structure to be actually a two-part structure. I think it's all of a piece. They're very important. It's part of the same tapestry. There is a lot of commentary here about white culture or dominant culture at large stealing from black culture, the best of black culture, whether it's music, fashion, design, street fashion, whatever it is, and borrowing from that and taking it over. And what we have are main characters that are fully formed people. They are not ciphers. Michael B. Jordan is incredible in these parts. He's so good. And they have relationships with other people that are really meaningful and really important. You know, there's a really lovely, beautiful love story here, but there's one of them. And then there's, you know, the relationship they have with their nephew or cousin, and the people in the town. And to see these black men come back down from Chicago and move about the world of the South in a different way than the people who had remained there.
There
is a scene of one of the brothers with their nephew going to the train station, which is predominantly white people. And Michael B. Jordan is just cutting through the crowd like he belongs there, which of course he does. And you can tell his cousin's like, what are we doing here? Like, why am I? And this is where they meet up with Delroy Lindo's character. And it is a very, you know, and there are other black people on the outskirts of the scene. And you can tell they have had a taste of something different in the North that they have had That they are not going to go back to what they had to put up with in the South. Not that things were great for them in Chicago, but better, right? So, and that they are here to create something better for themselves and for their community.
Yeah.
Which is why they're opening this juke joint. It is for them and them alone. And that is, they state that, you know, this movie blew my mind. It really did in a lot of ways. Yeah. But
I agree. The transition from the first part of the movie with the setup into the action leading up to the finale was pretty seamless.
Mm-hmm.
It's reviewers that have made that division between part one and part two, not so much me. And also, when you're talking about how they move about differently than the people that live there, it doesn't hurt that Michael B. Jordan is a certified badass. This is the guy
Creed.
You know, he's not somebody you want to mess with. Mm. But let's talk about the women in the movie.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
There's three main women characters, four, I guess, if you count the singer who becomes a vampire. But both the brothers, who are named Smoke and Stack, off an old Howlin' Wolf blues song, Smokestack Lightning. They're named Smoke and Stack. They both left love interests when they went off to fight in World War I and then settled in Chicago. And their choice of lovers was very different. One is a kind of a naturalist earth mother type. And the other one is I think she's one quarter black and can pass for white, but said, I never wanted to pass for white. I just wanted to be with you.
Mm.
Mm-hmm.
But she causes a problem later in the movie that I'll let you watch it.
I think I would want to take this opportunity to plug that episode from Blues Junction.
It's the regular blues show, and I'm one of the blues collective people. I do once a month.
Okay.
And what I did was I took selections from the soundtrack, which is not out yet in CD or vinyl, but it is available through iTunes.
Okay.
How I got it. The soundtrack, by the way, is not all blues. There's some more contemporary music on there as well, and Irish music, with classic blues stuff representing that Mississippi to Chicago continuum that took place. Like I said, they did right by the music, although it's not completely historically accurate. Some people complained about in A Complete Unknown, the Bob Dylan movie, that they didn't get the dates quite lined up, like when was Johnny Cash at Newport. Big deal. Same thing here. The song Wang Dang Doodle, which kind of kicks off the jam at the dance hall.
Tell Automatic Slim, tell Razor.
The movie set in 1932. Wang Dang Doodle was a hit 30 years later.
Uh-huh.
It doesn't matter. It fits. It totally fits the mood of the movie.
And they've also established that the music and the performers exist in some spiritual realm simultaneously, drawn together through the music to this location.
It suggests that, although pretty much for the movie, it's real life going on around it.
You've convinced me to not believe any of the reviews, and that the movie is well thought out and really works and is an important statement. So you guys have me convinced.
You know, when you say an important statement, it makes it sound like this movie is preachy or something like that. It is not. It's a ride. There's a lot of stuff going on in this movie. And I always like to call out the production values. And I'm going to say the costuming, production values, everything, really impeccable, truly beautiful. They create the two brothers that Michael B. Jordan are playing. They are wearing, you know, they're wearing their fly suits. And, you know, coming down from Chicago, but I'll tell you, they're very individual. You know, it's really, I was really impressed. It's a feast for the eyes, truly.
And another plus is there's no Abraham Lincoln vampire slayer involved. It's just, it didn't blend that many genres.
No, true.
In any case, okay, well, I'm feeling inclined to wrap it up, but any concluding thoughts?
I have a couple of concluding thoughts.
Good.
A lot to think about in this movie, and I've spent a lot of time thinking about it, and I finally came to the conclusion that there are a few things about it that where you're better off not thinking about it too much.
Oh.
Because it is so entertaining.
Yeah.
And the music is so good. Don't let anything get in the way with it the way Armand White did or whoever.
There are a lot of big themes and a lot of difficult topics and subjects this movie brings up, I think especially for people who are not people of color, which can be really difficult to, you know, if you're part of the, you know, I'm saying this as an white woman, okay? If you are part of the dominant culture, it can be difficult to hear what the people in the non-dominant cultures think or feel or experiencing. Please don't avoid this movie for that reason. I did not find this movie painful to watch, except for the truly painful things that happen.
Oh, yeah.
That should not happen. I don't mean, I'm not talking about the vampires. I'm talking about really bad people, you know? Yeah. So, but Doug knows I don't go to the movies to learn anything. I don't go to the movies. I want to be entertained. And this movie is incredibly entertaining. Is it eye-opening? Is it awakening? Absolutely. But you know what? You can have that little spoonful. You know, sugar helps the medicine go down. And, you know, I think we all need that. And just a couple of things, like, for people who are going to see this movie, just things that you should keep in mind. Please see this movie on the largest screen possible. It was filmed in essentially modern day Panavision. It is designed to be seen on a big screen, and stay till after the credits. You will not regret it.
Well, also the sound design for this film has been getting a lot of attention too. Apparently, extremely sophisticated sound design. I'll bet, especially in that scene where the music past and future comes to the juke joint.
So agreed, with echoing Mona, don't leave early.
Yeah, there okay, good.
Two codas, and you want to see them both. We should mention the name of the young actor who plays Sammy, the young blues singer. Uh-huh. It's Miles Catone.
He is incredible. What a revelation. I was not familiar with him. Wow. You know, I mean, we first saw Michael B. Jordan in what was the movie that took place in Seattle where the kids turn into superheroes, but then everything goes wrong?
Oh, I forget, but yeah.
That was the first thing I saw him in. But Fruitvale Station is the one where people really took notice of him. Uh-huh. And I think we have a similar thing here with Miles Catone. He blew me away. Wow, he really, and when you can hold your own in scenes with Michael Jordan and Delroy Lindo
and play music and guitar at the same time.
Yes,
this guy has a one in a generation voice.
I agree.
Being a good actor.
Yeah, you know, he makes sure
if he has a music career in front of him. Mm-hmm. Haley Steinfeld.
Yeah, Steinfeld.
Mm-hmm. Also has a dual career as an actor and as a singer.
Mm-hmm.
She's on the soundtrack. And there are a couple of cameos for those in the know. Saul Williams, who's like this really hip poet rapper.
Mm-hmm.
He plays a preacher, young Sammy's dad, and Buddy Guy, last man standing from the generation of Southern musicians. Buddy's actually not from Mississippi. He's from Louisiana next door, but who moved up to Chicago, Muddy Waters, Howlin' Wolf. He's the last man standing of that generation. He makes an appearance late in the movie that you don't want to miss.
I don't know about you, Rick, but when he came on the screen, I was really moved. I was like, oh, Buddy Guy. I couldn't believe it. That was inspired casting.
Yep.
That's exciting. You know, guys have made me so excited to see this movie. I can't wait. And you've also made me really, through our discussion, made me realize, as I said earlier, the thoughtfulness that went into it, as well as, you know, some commercialization, you know, making it a vampire movie. But I can see how the vampire part really does fit in with the folk world that that he's creating out of, you know, Mississippi roots and blues.
Well, you know, the vampires aren't just vampires, though, right? I mean, right. There's a lot of symbolism here, but again, not preachy, right?
So, yeah, exactly. Yeah. All right. Well, we've been talking to Rick Mitchell of Blues Junction, so do listen to that episode from Saturday,
Saturday, May 10th.
And then also Mona Bowen, who is regular. And
yeah, the New York Times reviewer called Ryan Coogler a multiplex visionary.
Oh, yeah.
And oh, I think
that pretty well sums it up.
That sums it up.
I think that's perfect. Yep.
Okay. Yeah. Well, thanks, guys. We'll talk again.
All right. All right, thank you.
Okay, let's turn it off the sound. And you're listening to Community Radio, KBOO Portland. Please consider becoming a member today. And we'll have Rick and Mona back again shortly. I'm sure there's plenty of movies that you guys, we could all three, especially when I see one, we could all discuss excitedly. You know, stuff coming up in later in the spring and summer. So, okay. Thank you guys. Once again, thanks, Rick, and thanks, Mona. And thank you for listening to Community Radio, KBOO Portland. No need to cry. Film at 11 will be back next Friday. So until then, keep watching the screens.
Something I've been wanting to tell you for a long time. It might hurt you, hope you don't lose your mind. Well, I was just a boy, about 8 years old. You threw me a Bible on that Mississippi road. See, I love you, Papa, you did all you could do. And they say the truth hurts, so I lied to you. Yes, I lied to you. I love the blues. Take me in your arms tonight. Oh.